Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist. With me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Jodie Matthews about her contemporary novel, Meet Me at the Surface. Jodie is from Cornwall and lives in Manchester. She was shortlisted for the Bath Novel Award and the Blue Pencil First Novel Award in 2021. In this episode, we discuss writing the weird and creepy, but keeping the world grounded. Researching the Cornish folklore of where Jodie grew up, and why she loves Bookstagram and thinks finding a community of readers is just as important as finding a writing community. But before we get into that, here's Jodie with an excerpt from Meet Me at the Surface.
With Jubilee Rock blocking my view of anything apart from the waist-high bracken, I felt like I could stay just there and forget about Trelawney completely. When night fell, I could shelter by the rock. In the morning, I could drink water from the stream. I would turn my trousers up at the ankles and stand barefoot in the river, catching brown trout with my hands, or maybe even a freshwater eel if I could bear the whistle of its slimy skin against my fingers. I would carry them back to my rock, fingers hooked through gills, eels worn around my wrists like cuffs. I'd find flint in amongst old ruins and start a fire as the fish baked in the afternoon heat on the hot stone, roast them on a spit. In summer, I would pick elderberries. In winter, blackberries. I would crush furred nettle leaves between hardened fingers and stew them in water over fire for my tea. I could stop, keep clear of the farmhouse altogether. My mum and aunt and all the ghosts could stay locked up there without me. I could miss the memorial, pretend I was still packed away in the city, avoid the faces of the people I'd left behind. My return would be just another rumour on the wind. I could live off the moor, hidden, another urban legend. The Beast of Bodmin and I, both creatures with too many stories to live up to. I scrambled to the top of Jubilee, the stone grazing my palms as I dragged my body upwards. Once there, I sat and licked the blood off my hands and looked across the moors. Above ground in sludge and mulch, where everything should blend into a smudge of earthy paint, I saw something moving between the bracken. The ferns bent over themselves, parting a green sea. I craned my neck and saw the docile horns of a Highland cow, but when the cow stopped to graze, the movement carried on ahead of it, disjointed. Even the gorse seemed to fold, creaking apart as something pushed through. For a moment, I thought I saw a person. Her. A black coat, a drape of material blurring in the bush.
Hi Jodie, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Meet Me at the Surface.
Thank you. Hello.
So good to have you, Jodie. Can you give us an intro to your novel and tell us what Meet Me at the Surface is about?
Of course. So Meet Me at the Surface is about a young woman called Merrin who grows up on Bodmin Moor and then moves to Manchester. She gets called back home by her mum for the memorial service of her ex-girlfriend. But when she goes back home to Bodmin Moor and the farmhouse that she grew up in, she finds that everything is slightly different. Everything is changed. Nothing really makes sense. She's asking lots of questions, but she isn't getting any answers. And something strange is happening out on the moors as well.
Yeah, I loved the kind of eeriness that this novel has, and the kind of blend of real life and folklore. And what one thing I thought was fantastically done was that your novel almost feels like a historical novel, and I really enjoyed that kind of feeling of this is now, but just slightly different. And I wondered where the inspiration came from, because I saw, I think it was an interview where you said that partly it was because you in lockdown you were kind of yearning for Cornwall. So I kind of wondered how it all began.
That's really interesting that you say that you kind of noticed or felt a bit of the historical side to it. Because when I first started writing this, or just before I started writing Meet Me at the Surface, I was trying to write historical fiction. So I wrote about, I don't know, maybe 10,000 words, 20,000 words of a historical fiction novel that just wasn't working at all. And then I kind of had writer's block with that. So I told myself, okay, just go and write something else for half an hour just to kind of get yourself back in the zone. And in that space of time when I was writing for fun, I wrote a scene of a girl traveling home to Cornwall and then going and having like a long bath. Which then became, and I was like, oh, this is really fun. Like, I found this really easy to write. And then that's when I abandoned the historical fiction and started to write Meet Me at the Surface. There is a lot of, I did quite a lot of research when I was writing it as well, which is why there is quite a fair amount, I think, about like the kind of history of Bodmin Moor and the area and the culture of those things. And I wanted to put that into the book because I thought, you know, that or Cornwall itself and it like that area of Cornwall does have such a deep history, and it's I think it's fascinating. It's where I grew up, so obviously I kind of I'm aware of all of it, but I think for a lot of people who have never been to Cornwall or have only ever been down there on holiday, there's one specific side of Cornwall that they see, or there are only certain things that they associate with Cornwall, which is beaches and, you know, Newquay and all of these things, which are all great and lovely. But, you know, I kind of wanted to shine a light on this other side, slightly darker side, more earthy, kind of more wild and rugged, which is where that came from. And yeah, because I was writing during lockdown and I was living in the Midlands at the time, I hadn't been able to go back home very often. So I got really sucked in to that, and I got really sucked into kind of researching about where I grew up and reminding myself of, you know, the places I would go to in my own childhood and looking things up and looking at pictures and all of that kind of stuff. And it was really nice. My childhood wasn't like Meryn's, obviously, luckily. And the Blisland that I grew up in is also different to the Blisland in the book, because that's what happens when you're writing kind of gothic fiction, I guess, or kind of horror in the way that this book is. Everything is slightly uncanny. Everything is slightly removed from the truth, which I think is what you said yourself a minute ago, like it's this world but slightly off.
Yeah, which is something I love in writing. Like, it's a real kind of fascination for me, because I find it's weird. I don't like horror films because I'm too scared. I don't like jump scares, can't do them, but I really enjoy kind of folk horror and that kind of the weirdness, and particularly in fiction. Like, I think it's brilliant. So picking up on that, where did this idea to make it into this kind of gothic folkloric kind of novel become? Because you kind of pepper it throughout the novel, these kind of like rituals and this kind of mythology. You even have like chapters throughout which are kind of this folklore. So how did you decide kind of how much to, because they're kind of mysterious. You read it and you're like, this is weird and I'm not quite sure what's going on, but I'm trusting Jodie that she's going to guide me through it. How did you decide kind of like how much to tease and how much to hold back?
Interesting. There was a lot of trial and error. There were a lot of different early versions, I suppose, of the book. Not full drafts, but I have a habit of I'll write something in one way. So, I'd kind of write the opening with more of the folklore and darker. And then I'd look at it and then I'd be like, okay, well, I like this bit and I like this bit and I like this bit. And I'd take those and I'd stick them into a new Word document. And then I'd be like, okay, now we'll try it like this. So there was a lot of that, a lot of trial and error to get to the point that I wanted it to be. I'd say earlier versions, there was probably more folklore and more of those chapters with that other voice. And then the contemporary parts of the story, or the parts that are in Meryn's voice, more of those were added in later, and that kind of focus on Meryn, so that the reader has somebody that can root them in the story, was added in as it went along, because I think that's something that's really important. And I can't remember who said it or where I read it, but I remember hearing a bit of advice that essentially you can go weird as long as your reader feels safe.
Right.
So it doesn't mean, obviously not literally safe, but your reader needs to kind of have something to hook on to or hold on to, and then you can take them to weirder spaces with your work. It's just that grounding. So Meryn was the grounding, and those kind of, the more contemporary bits in it. So the scenes that are set in the pub and in cafes and things like that, the bits of the world as we understand it, to me, those are the grounding parts of the story. And that makes us go, okay, I understand what's happening here. So now I can suspend disbelief
Yeah.
and I can let myself kind of follow these weird trails. There was more folklore chapters originally. And then when I was editing, first with my agent Liv and then with my editor Katie, we chopped them up, kind of spread them more throughout the book and made them slightly shorter. There were definitely bits in there originally that just had no relevance to the plot at all. That I'd written them because I was like, I love this. Like, this
Yeah.
is spooky. This is fun. This is weird and interesting. And the feedback I get on those bits would be like, you're right. This is spooky and fun and interesting. We don't need it in here.
Yeah.
I was like, that's fine. So
Save
there's
that for
definitely,
another project. So you never know. You never know.
yeah, you save everything. I just,
Yeah.
lifted those bits, stuck them in a new Word document of cut pieces to come back to at another point.
Yeah. Great idea. Can you tell us a little bit more about Meryn and her family? Because obviously, when she goes home, I guess their normal is normal to her, but us as reader will look at it and think their lifestyle is a little bit unusual.
It's interesting. So when I first started writing, when I first started writing Meryn, it was kind of immediate that I wrote her living with her mother, or growing up with her mother and with her aunt as well. That was just the automatic, like, family dynamic that I leant towards. It just felt right that she'd grow up with sisters without any, or with her mum and her mum's sister, without any outside influence in the home, which I think was quite an important element in order to give that, not just that isolation, but that kind of that intense connection between the three of them. And this idea of, needing to protect their family unit from the outside world. So that was really important. And then as far as their lifestyle goes, that's a really interesting question. There were parts whilst I was writing it where certain things I didn't think were as weird as when other people read them. So there's things like, there's a section where Meryn is going to make herself some toast in the morning, and then she sees that the bread has some mold on it, and then her mum is telling her to just cut it off. And I remember, who was it? think it was an early reader, but I remember someone being like, oh, that was, you know, such a strange suggestion. And I was
Oh,
like,
they used to do that to me, so I don't
yeah.
have to.
Yeah.
She'd be like,
I
oh,
knew
it's just on the
plenty of
edge,
people.
just a green bit, just cut it off.
Just
So,
snip it off.
yeah,
But yeah, I think growing up where I did grow up as well, there were definitely people that I knew, or some of my friends and their parents who still held certain beliefs. So with things like the Beast of Bodmin, it's a bit of local folklore that there is this big black cat, possibly a puma, some kind of beast that skulks around the moors and kills livestock. Jamaica Inn has or had a little museum in it that we could go to as kids that had like a whole section on sightings of the beast and stuff like that. And I knew people who swore down that they'd seen it and that it was real and that they'd seen it whilst they were out riding horses and stuff like that. So there are these little pockets of belief still, which is just fascinating. And it was something that I knew that I wanted to really explore those characters, I guess, or those people that kind of open their minds in that way and go, okay, like this might be science, but this is what I grew up with. These are the stories that I've heard, and I'm gonna put real belief into this, and I'm gonna hold on to that. And I wanted to explore, I suppose, how having those beliefs could affect Maren's life, or how her mum kind of bringing her up in this way would affect how Maren feels. And then there's also her mum, you know, isn't mentally well throughout the book and throughout her childhood. So I wanted to bring those two things in as well. They kind of felt like, yeah, her mum's general instability mixed with her mum having been brought up with lots of superstitions as well, how those things would feed into each other and how that would then feed into Meryn's isolation and her relationship with her mum and her aunt.
yeah, I love the way those things are connected. And actually, I've read a few books this year which kind of explore this idea of kind of mental health and folklore and superstition, and I find it fascinating, the kind of links between them and how perhaps it's easier to lean on superstition maybe when you're having a hard time, because it's like those beliefs maybe give you that faith that you can't get elsewhere. And it's interesting for Merrin as well, having moved away from that, and having, I think that's quite a classic trope, isn't it? That kind of character coming back to their childhood, with like home, and kind of seeing things in a different way. But obviously there are other topics you explore in the novel, things like grief and what it's like to be queer among like people who are not particularly accepting, in, like you say, quite an isolated, quite closed off community, I suppose. Did you go into the novel thinking these are the things that I would really like to speak about, or were they kind of things that cropped up as you were writing?
I think mainly they cropped up whilst I was writing. I automatically wrote Meryn as queer, and as bisexual without, I suppose, much thought regarding, you know, what is this going to say? And it was only as I wrote more where, you know, I started to think about that. Grief was an early point that I knew I wanted to include. As soon as I'd gotten the idea of Meryn and, you know, Meryn having this important relationship in her life, which is the relationship that she has with Claude, and I knew that I wanted to bring Meryn back home, it just made a lot of sense to me. It was, I think, a lot of the book in a way is about closure or an attempt to find closure. So, you know, Meryn's, she's left home, she's gone away from what she knows, and then she comes back and she has to look at everything from a changed position with new eyes, and she She's coming to terms with how she was brought up. She's coming to terms with how unwell her mum might be. She's coming to terms with lots of things about herself. And the grief as well, coming to terms with the idea that she has lost Claude and that their relationship wasn't the best. And that, you know, the point in which she lost her, they weren't in a good place. I think that was an important thing for me to explore, or something that I really wanted to keep prodding at, is this idea of, yeah, wanting closure but not being able to get it, because that's reality. I think there's definitely a temptation, especially when you write fiction, or there's a temptation when I was writing anyway, to neaten everything up and find the most satisfying conclusion for each problem and tie everything with a bow. But that's just not realistic. And I think sometimes, instead of having all of the answers when you're writing something or when you're reading something, having all of the answers, sometimes it's more important to have questions still, or to have things that make the reader kind of think a bit more. And I think that was where those kind of explorations of grief came in. And yeah, with the queerness, I tried not to focus too much on elements of homophobia and things like that, because I didn't want it to be just a horrible experience to read. But I did think it was important at the same time to tell the story of a young bi woman, and to tell a different kind of story again. I mean, I didn't want to just show a kind of perfect, happy relationship. And I think queer joy is so important, and it's so important in fiction. And we're getting a lot of great books at the moment, particularly in terms of rom-coms, that are just bursting with queer joy, and they're so nice to read. But I also think that it's important to look at different relationships as well. So I read a lot, and I read a lot of books with heterosexual people in, with straight people in, and they get to really explore different relationship dynamics. And I wanted to do that for bi people as well, to kind of say, okay, yeah, we can have it really great, but we can also have it confusing and complex. And, you know, all relationships are complex, all people are complex. And yeah.
Yeah, that's always the problem, isn't it? When there are fewer books that have that representation, because you feel like you have to do some sort of service and
yes,
provide everything, when it's actually, sometimes you just want to write a dark novel with a dark relationship. And you don't, you know, as much as you want to experience queer joy when you're reading, you don't necessarily always want to write that story. But like you say, obviously the choices that you made were to try and kind of limit that, the complete bleakness in your life, but it's pretty dark around it anyway. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about your kind of the way you write, because your writing on a sentence level is just sublime, and I'm gobbling the sentences off the page. The way your imagery comes across is just outstanding, and I wondered whether that is something that comes easy to you, or are you, you know, editing and sharpening images as you go? Kind of, is it a bit more of that, or is it a bit more of kind of it's just instinctive for you?
Thank you so much. That's one of the things I said from the beginning, is as long as people like it on a sentence level, then I'm happy. You can hate the storyline, but I just want people to like it on a sentence level. It comes naturally in a way, but only through having worked on it a lot previously, I suppose. I used to write a lot of poetry, or have written a lot of poetry. So the kind of the sentence level imagery is something that's very important to me. And when I was first writing, I find myself writing in little chunks. It was almost like a series of short stories or tiny little prose filled paragraphs. And I get really into the weeds of a sentence, and get quite bogged down in that as well. So I'd really focus on how lyrical something was, or how it would sound if it was read out loud, or what that imagery would be. And then it was the other bit that was more complicated or that I found harder, which was taking all of these little vignettes and all of these tiny little notes that I made and actually making them into a story. I think Heather Parry wrote about this recently. She wrote an article that
I shared it. I
yeah.
thought it was spot on because
perfect.
I'll put it in the show notes actually, because I'm terrible for doing this in writing a situation and not a story.
Yes.
Which is
exactly
anyway, you're just like, oh, you know, these two people are polar opposites. Wouldn't it be great if they sat on a bench? And then you're like, yeah, but it's not a story.
No, exactly. That's the thing. Writing a situationship or writing an image, I suppose, in a way, or a scene. And that is how I would do it. I would think about something and I would think, okay, I want to write a walk across the moors, or I want to write these people having a coffee and this happens, or I really want to write about this, you know, specific plant or this piece of folklore. These are the things that I want to have, and I do that, and then yeah, kind of afterwards would be like, right, okay, this has to service the story in some way, this has to move the characters along, or this, you know, it has to do something. So yeah, that's kind of the way it would work.
Speaking of like the other side then, when you'd got all these lovely little bits kind of vignettes and poetry and images, how did you think, okay, how am I going to build a story from that? Are you a planner? Do you do mood boards? Like what's your kind of method?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I would love to be a planner. I've tried and I find it so difficult. I tried it all. I tried spreadsheets. Somebody told me to plan out each chapter and write a line for what was going to happen in each chapter, and I just hated it. I found it very difficult. The only way I managed to really get it to work was to just write around it, I suppose. I had an idea of where I wanted the story to go. I had an idea of where I wanted to end the story, and then I would just sit and write. I'd write whatever chunk was interesting me the most at the time. So I didn't write in chronological order, which I wouldn't recommend. it's not very helpful when it comes to piecing everything together. But yeah, I just kind of write around it, which means you end up writing a lot more than you need, and you end up deleting a lot, which is fine. But I'm trying to think of how much I planned. When I had my synopsis nailed, that was probably the most amount of planning I did. So I had the synopsis, I had an idea, and then I made sure that everything fit with that. But really, I think when the story became the Titus was when I started to work with my agent, who obviously read the whole thing, and she's such a great editor, and she had so many good ideas, and she really helped focus this like meandering story that I had. And we had a lot of discussions, and she kind of prodded this good story out of me, which was really helpful because I had it in my head. I knew what I wanted to do, but it's just actually getting that down and kind of taking it from like, this is an interesting story, and making it, you know, getting it on the page. I think having those plot points or an idea of how to, or like where to hook the plot at each point really helped. And then I managed to get it to what it is. It's interesting. I've had some like early reviews and stuff like that, which have been great and really exciting to read. And I've had some people talk about, you know, it being really tightly plotted and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, that's so nice to hear, because for so long to me, it was this kind of, it was a, what do they say? No plot, just vibes. That's what it was. So it's lovely to know that the bits that took a lot of work, which were things like making sure that this, you know, the slightly more complicated elements of the story made sense. It's so nice to see that people can see that and that it was worthwhile, because it was hard.
Yeah, that plotting is the worst, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You had some really amazing opportunities in the kind of lockdown era, I want to say, 2021, that kind of time. You won a membership to the London Library. You also were shortlisted for the Bath Novel Award, which is when I first discovered you, and I was like, this is someone whose career I want to follow. And the Blue Pencil First Novel Award too. How did all these things change your writing career? Did they lead you towards an agent? How did it all pan out for you?
Oh, they were so important. So I started writing the book, or a version of the book, I guess, at the very end of 2019, early 2020. And that was when I actually got the London Library membership, was I think early or spring 2020. And that changed so much of the story. It was so helpful. It was Jesse Burton was running the competition, and there were three different age categories that you could enter in, and you had to send over a pitch and a little bit about yourself and a pitch of your novel, and then you could win a year-long membership. And I was lucky enough to win one. And what that did for me, I was living kind of in the middle of nowhere. I'd been working as a gardener at a big historical estate at the time, and we were furloughed for about 4 months, 3 months, and obviously couldn't go anywhere because I was in a village. There was no library, there was nothing like that. And having access to the London Library and all of their online resources just really blew the book wide open. They have a really great thing there where you can email them and you can say, I want to research these things, and then they'll come back to you and they'll be like, here are all the books that you need. And then you can request that they send them to you. It was amazing. It was It was such a great program, and it was so helpful. And a lot of so much of what I've written in the folklore sections and about the history of Cornwall, things like that, that are in the cultural history of Cornwall especially, came from the research that I was able to do with the London Library. Because prior to that, I only had, you know, the kind of knowledge that's passed down, and you just, you know stories that you grew up with, but you don't know details. So that was so helpful, and especially as well, being awarded that membership gave me confidence that my idea was good. And from there, I applied to some different mentoring schemes as well. So with a very early version of the book, I worked with Cunning Folk, the magazine, with their mentoring scheme, and had Molly Aitken, the writer of The Island Child, which is excellent. So she mentored me on a very early version of the book, which was really helpful. Who else did I work with? I worked with Alan Trotter as well, the author of Muscle, on an early version of the book, which was really helpful. And then Tom DePreston, when he opened up the mentorship. So he was like a long-term mentor to me. And essentially we'd get on Zoom during lockdown and we'd just talk, and we'd talk about the book, and he just gave a lot of really helpful advice. And it was because of Tom that I started to enter awards, because he kind of gave me that push and was like, this is good enough, you should enter. So I entered Bath Novel Award and the BPA and got longlisted for those and got very excited. And it was around, I think it was just before the longlisting, that I sent the book out to agents. I'd sent an earlier version out to agents at the end of 2020 to about 5, and didn't get any bites. Reworked the whole beginning, spoke to Charlie Carroll, who is the author of The Lip as well, who's another Cornish author, who I kind of reached out to on Twitter because I loved his book. And I was like, I'm querying at the moment, I've written something about Cornwall, I'd love it if you could read my early pages. And he was amazing and said yes and helped me neaten up my query letter. So I then sent that out for the second time, and heard back from Liv almost, I think I sent it out to her on like a Saturday or a Sunday, and I heard back from her on the Monday that she was reading and she was enjoying it. So that was incredible. And then I got shortlisted for both awards as well. And yeah, me and Liv worked together on the book. And then April 2020, we went out on submission. And I prepared myself for a really long submission period, because that's what normally happens. But I was super lucky. And I think we sent it out on a Monday afternoon. And then by the Tuesday, we'd heard back from Fourth Estate and from Katie. And she said that she'd read it overnight, I think, and that she really liked it, and it all kind of went from there. But it was definitely a team effort. I think I was very grateful, because I had no, you know, I had no connections to the publishing industry before then. I don't have a degree. I was just doing this by myself, kind of sat in the Midlands writing away at a computer, working in a garden full time. So I think the power of social media and just kind of getting these opportunities, and that was something I was really grateful for as well. And I think we especially saw a lot of it during lockdown, is that there were a lot of authors who were offering up these kind of services and reaching out and saying to people, you know, I'm here, I can help. Yeah. And that's such a great thing for people to do. And I would say
on the whole that, maybe it doesn't feel like it, but a lot of authors are very approachable and
yes,
probably would, you know, do you a favor, or do you, I mean, I'm not mm-hmm. asking to read your whole book, but, you know, I think if you're just asking for a bit of advice or something, I know a lot of authors do it, just kind of, they'll pick random people on Twitter to help or whatever. And I think that's amazing. And obviously I always say, take up any opportunity that's in your way, you know, competitions, submissions, whatever you can get, because I mean, for you it's kind of almost reassuring that it wasn't just your long listing that got you an agent. You were already impressing people before then, so then having that on top must have been like the cherry on the cake for Liv when she was like, oh, and not only is she my client, she's also shortlisted for this prize and this award. Yeah. It's a great thing then for you to be able to put forward in your kind of submission pitch when you're submitting to publishers. So that's great. You also mentioned Bookstagram in your acknowledgement. How significant that community was to you as part of your writing career. Just kind of tell us briefly, because I don't want to spoil your lovely kind of there's an amazing post on Instagram which I will link to, where you kind of thank everyone and explain like why everyone was so but just give us an outline as to why that really lifted you.
Yeah, so I love that whole community so much. I think it was again probably around November 2019, and I can remember it quite well because I was off work with some kind of flu or something and had spent all that time reading, and I hadn't read in ages, but I couldn't watch TV or do anything because I felt too sick. So I just sat and read a load of books, and for some reason I think I searched one on Instagram or I'd seen a post or something, and then that was when I discovered the Bookstagram community. I didn't know it was a thing before then, and I was just like, oh, this is interesting, this is nice, like look at all these people, look how much they love books. And I made an account and started to share my reading as well, and it was so fun. Like I in that first year that I had it, so in 2020, and I'm sure this was because of lockdown as well and because being furloughed and things like that, but I read more than I'd ever read in my life, and I read more widely than I'd ever read. And I, you know, I discovered different genres for the first time, and I kind of moved out of my comfort zone, and I got to know loads of great people. And, you know, as a Bookstagrammer, I built my account up, and I was being sent early proofs by publishers, which just blew my mind the first time it happened. I think the first one I was ever sent was from John Murray's, and it was Michelle Gallen's book, Big Girl, Small Town. And that's what it's called. It's just an amazing book. But I remember getting it through the post and just being like, oh my God, like this hasn't even been published yet. This is crazy. Wow. Yeah, it was so exciting to me. And when I started to share about my writing, everyone was so supportive, which was just, it was just wonderful. And, you know, it was through having a Bookstagram account that I saw things like Jesse Burton advertising the fact that she was running this competition. And, you know, that was how I found out about Charlie Carroll's book, The Lip. And that was how I, like, found out about Tom and the fact that Tom was open for mentoring and all of these kind of things. And it really just, it opened up this whole world for me. And I think being able to see authors on there and to see them, you know, sharing about the process and the process of publishing and the process of writing is something that's super helpful. But also getting to know all of these other readers and getting to spend time around like-minded people and people who are just like so in love with books, who have such smart opinions and just read in a way where they're just, I don't know, everybody is just reading so openly and applying like really smart criticism to books as well. And it just, I find it really inspiring to know that, you know, or to learn and to be able to see that there are people who are really engaging with books in that way. So then when I was writing, I just found it inspiring. And it's kind of the idea that people, that I knew that people would pick this up, and that hopefully I would be able to reach people who would really appreciate the book in that way. It was a really, really exciting thing for me when I was writing. And it's been one of the best things about the process so far, I think, especially now that proof copies have gone out to Bookstagrammers. There are people that have the book who I followed when I very first made my account, and they followed me when I, you know, so there are people that I've known for years that way. And there are people who've read book like a very, very early version before it had gone anywhere, when it wasn't very good. And to be able to send them like a proof copy or a finished copy and to be like, it's here, it just yeah, it's been a really lovely process, and I think it's so great to have had that community whilst I was writing the book, and to still have that community now as well, because everyone's so supportive, and it's just, I wouldn't change it for anything. It's been lovely. It's really good.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you really what advice you'd give to anyone who's perhaps just signed a book contract and mm-hmm. is about to have their first book published. But I guess hearing you speak then, probably I'm assuming your tip would be kind of like, find your people, find your community.
Yeah, I think it's really great. You see a lot of people connecting with other authors, which is brilliant and really good as well. But I think, yeah, I definitely say that connecting with readers is just as important as connecting with other writers, because readers are the people that are gonna really champion you, and for a long time as well. It's not just like, oh, we're only interested in your first book or whatever. These people really, really go all in, and it's wonderful. I think another bit of advice as well, which is kind of contrary to all of what I've just said, is probably to not spend too much time on the internet. I think there needs to be a balance, and I think that's really, really important. And that's what I've been trying to do as well, so that I don't panic too much in the run-up to the book coming up, because it's so easy to compare yourself as well, and you can compare your campaign, or you can compare your novel, or you can compare your experience and all of these different things, and everybody is going to be comparing themselves probably negatively to other people. There's always someone who you think is doing better or something like that, and it's such a shame when that happens, I think, because if you're spending too long comparing yourselves to other people, you're taking away from the fact that you have achieved this thing that is likely something that you've wanted forever and is so amazing. And then you don't want to be like, oh, well, I think that person got more money than me. Like, that's not what it's about. So I think spending a little less time on the internet, and
definitely good advice.
I'm distracting myself as much as possible at the moment, and playing a lot of Skyrim, which is very helpful to just kind of remind myself, just things like that, where I'm just like, you know, this is exciting, but this is, it is what it is. Like, I can't spend too much time getting too caught up.
I mean, realistically, apart from kind of publicity and stuff, your job's done now, so you can you can switch off a bit. But there is something you can't switch off of, which is the future and next project. So finally, on that note, Jodie, can you give us a little hint or a little tease about what might be coming next from you?
Yeah, so I am writing another book with Fourth Estate, and I'm very excited about it. It's very hard. It's what I can say. I don't think I can give away much about the plot.
That's
or
fine.
The characters or anything like that.
Is it, would you say kind of slightly similar? Is it historical, modern day? What gives that?
So it's contemporary, so it's modern day. And it is, I guess, yeah, it's slightly similar in the way that there will still be kind of gothic elements and that kind of folk horror feeling still, but different in certain ways. It's difficult because it's hard not to give too much away as well, because I think if you give too much away when you're in the process of writing, the finished product could be so
totally
different to what it is now.
So it also kills a bit of that magic, doesn't it, I think, when you're working on something. So I won't ask you anything else. I'll just wait patiently for the next one. And very much looking forward to it. But let's concentrate on the first one first. Thank you so much, Jodie, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's been great.
That was Jodie Matthews talking about her contemporary novel, Meet Me at the Surface, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop
hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.